Hi, I'm Alistair Madden, and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 10 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we explored Italian football's evolving managerial landscape. We dissected the Bundesliga's hectic Hinrunde, and we analysed Real Madrid's resilience. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order of what we discussed and when. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe, hopefully you're all staying well, and hopefully you all had a lovely Christmas. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. Well, we hope you had a very Merry Christmas, but it's back to business for the Road to Nowhere European podcast. We're at that point in between Christmas and New Year when, as we said in the last podcast, nobody really knows what day it is, but it is Wednesday. It's just gone 4 o'clock. I'm heading out to Paisley later on this evening, so we've got a tight window in which to record the episode, but Michael Jones is primed and ready to go. Rudy Barlow will be joining us shortly, and yeah, we'll have another bumper episode for you, the listener, to enjoy. Michael Jones, how are you? How was your Christmas?
Yeah, it was good, thank you. It was quite quiet. I think it's getting to that point where we're like definitely hitting peak late 20s now, even, because I've noticed that like generally the kind of activities tends to involve a lot less drinking than it used to, but I think that's for the best, although I have still been a bit ill over Christmas. But yeah, other than that, it's been really nice spending a lot with family and whatnot. What about you?
Yeah, Michael, it was a lovely Christmas, spending time with the nearest and dearest, very relaxing, ate lots of food, drank lots of beer, and yeah, just generally relaxed. So altogether enjoyable. Now, yeah, Kilmarnock will probably do away with a lot of that happiness this evening, but for the time being, at least, I'm very happy and very merry. And I think what would actually make me even merrier, Michael, is to hear your dulcet tones telling us all about the latest goings on in Italy. Now, while a gripping Serie A title race has dominated the Italian football headlines, we've seen no shortage of storylines and skirmishes for position across the wider division. With just 5 points separating 4th and 9th and 4 points between 15th and 19th, Italian football's top flight has this season served up a feast of unpredictability. Against that backdrop, Michael, could we perhaps make an argument that Serie A is currently one of the most competitive leagues in Europe?
Absolutely. I think you could make a case for the title, as we've talked about a lot on the last few episodes. That looks like we could have a real title race on our hands this season. But yeah, elsewhere, like you mentioned, you know, Champions League, Europa League, and the battle for relegation, they're not just, you know, open and enthralling battles so far this season, but it also looks like there'll be plenty of teams at the table looking to be a part of that. And I think one of the reasons behind this has been the sort of contrasting fortunes of the likes of Bologna and Fiorentina, who have been two of the massive success stories in Italian football this season, when we're starting to see the real emergence of potential future stars in Italian and European football. Joshua Zirkzee, we talked about a lot on the podcast recently, as we have done with Lewis Ferguson at Bologna, but at Fiorentina, Nico Gonzalez has had an excellent campaign, although he's been struggling with injury a bit more of late. And Lucas Beltran, another Argentinian who arrived from River Plate, he scored the winning goal versus Monza the other night. And the sort of systems which are being created by these two managers, who ultimately are the stars of the show, for Bologna, Thiago Motta, and for Fiorentina, Vincenzo Italiano, we've been given the time to build sustainable, attractive projects, and they're really reaping the rewards for it at the moment. You know, Bologna are on 31 points. They're just 2 points off AC Milan. They've lost just two games all season. And arguably, most notably, their best success has come outside of Italian football this season. They beat Inter Milan the other week in the Coppa Italia. And Fiorentina themselves have been sort of plugging along very nicely whilst progressing to the last 16 of the Europa Conference League. But then beneath them, yeah, you've got this kind of contrasting tale with the likes of Roma, Napoli, Atalanta and Lazio. Long-term future for many of the managers and projects, I guess, is under some form of scrutiny. You know, I think Mourinho's in the last year of his contract. We know fully well about the Napoli changes in the dugout over the course of the season. And Napoli, I think, is one of the odd things about them is they've still been one of the most creative teams. They've created the most sort of shot-creating actions in the league this season, but their goals haven't been able to match up to that. They've only scored 28 goals, which isn't too bad by all intents and purposes. But if you compare that to Inter Milan, who are leading the charts on 41, it's quite a big gulf in there, on the same as Atalanta. And then Lazio, a team, I think Lazio and Atalanta with Maurizio Sarri and Gasperini, the two managers that you're just wondering at what point they're going to continue working on these projects, because Lazio are in the bottom half. They've averaged a goal a game so far this season. As for Atalanta, they've kind of been in this difficult transitional phase where they've gone a couple of months with next to no wins, a slight reprieve before Christmas before struggling again in their last game, which they lost. And Lazio, likewise, have struggled with injury, struggled with the departure. All these teams have struggled with the departures of key players. You can think of Sergej Milinkovic-Savic, Rasmus Højlund, Kim Min-jae for Napoli, for Fiorentina. They've also lost key players like Sofyan Amrabat and Arnautovic for Bologna. But yeah, it's just been one of those seasons. And I think all these factors coming together have created, from, you know, from ninth to fourth, there's 7 points. Like you said, there's a 5-point gap from eighth to fourth. If you include AC Milan, there's just 9 points from ninth to third. And there's so many of these managers where, I guess, there's such uncertainty. You know, Stefano Pioli, Mazzarri, even though he's only just taken the Napoli job, and it's created this, yeah, fiesta of competitiveness in Italian football. And then, yeah, down the opposite end of the table as well, it's been a really, really intriguing season so far, partially due to so many clubs making ultra slow starts to their campaigns. Empoli have averaged, despite their XG being almost a goal a game, they've scored just 8 goals in 17 games this season, and they find themselves second from bottom. And then Sassuolo all the way up in 15th, despite Domenico Berardi and Andrea Pinamonti having brilliant campaigns. You know, two of the top 10 scorers in Serie A the season. Berardi's second highest on 9 goals. They've just not been able to find the fluidity enough and the solidity for them to get results consistently. But fortunately for the teams around them, you know, I think there's only been about 3 wins from these 6 teams collectively over the last 24 games, so the last 4 games each between the 6. So it's been a real sort of telltale sign of these teams. If one of them is able to find some form, Udinese, for example, have lost less games. They're 17th. They've lost less games than Napoli so far this season. They've only lost 5. Napoli have lost 6, but they've only won 1 game and drawn 11. And they're guided by former Crawley Town manager, Gabriele Cioffi, who has seemed to steady the ship. A few of these teams have had managerial changes at the bottom. But yeah, these teams are certainly looking for some kind of inspiration going into the new year. So whilst you've had this kind of unpredictability towards the top end of the season, there's been this real struggle for so many teams in Italian football this season to get up and running.
Yeah, Michael, it's been a really interesting league, certainly to watch from afar. You'll be much closer to it than I am. But as an outsider, it does feel like, yeah, Italian football has once again delivered a highly competitive campaign so far. Anyway, I suppose now, Michael, looking ahead, what can we maybe expect to change as we enter the second half of the season?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I mean, there's the big question over the likes of Bologna and Fiorentina. not just over whether they can sort of keep this consistent form going. They'll have other tournaments. Fiorentina will be looking to go one better than they did in the Conference League when they lost to West Ham in the final last season. I'm sure that will be a massive priority for them, despite Aston Villa being in that tournament. Whilst Bologna now, I'm sure, after beating Inter Milan, probably the best team in Italy so far this season, they'll be really eyeing up proper progression in the Coppa Italia as well. But for the teams below them as well, you know, these Champions League places up for grabs, there is the potential as it stands. I believe Italy are due 5 places in the new format of the Champions League next season. I don't expect that to remain going into next season, but they should be there or thereabouts at the very least. And, you know, financially wise, this could be huge for so many of these clubs and could dictate their next few years in terms of what players they're able to attract or stuff. So how much teams are going to prioritise on Serie A over Europe? I think teams have put a lot of effort into getting to the next stages of the European tournaments, but whether they realistically believe many of them, you know, the likes of Lazio and Napoli getting to the round of 16 and the Champions League, think that they have a good chance of winning that, I highly doubt it. However, you do suspect that they will believe that they can make a big push in the second half of the season and try and catch up with Fiorentina and Bologna. So how they get on in those respects will be really interesting. But I think what's also interesting is that if we talk about that managerial uncertainty, not just at those clubs, but at AC Milan with Pioli as well. So Napoli, I don't expect Mazzarri to be there next season unless he has a drastic turnaround. Maurizio Sarri, there could be questions over him. Jose Mourinho, I definitely don't expect to be at Rome, and I don't think I'd expect Pioli to be at AC Milan at the end of this season. So that opens the doors, unless the likes of Antonio Conte returns, that it really opens the doors for the next generation of sort of burgeoning managers in Italy to potentially succeed. And the second half of the season may all be a bit of a final dance. I think it certainly could be for Vincenzo Italiano at Fiorentina. I think he's certainly proved that he's ready to take the next step, having both shown consistent success in Italy and in Europe. And Thiago Motta's been heavily linked, partly due to his playing career, but because of the brand of football he's introduced in Emilia-Romagna. He's been heavily linked with the Barcelona job, Barlow was saying in the last episode, and the PSG job, where he spent, you know, successful periods as a player at both clubs. And, you know, if Inter Milan are able to throw this league away, maybe linked with Inter Milan as well. And what's interesting about that is, I guess it kind of opens up the managers to look at those potential Fiorentina Bologna jobs. I feel like we're due a huge turnover of coaches, of players, to build these teams for the next few years towards the end of the season. It feels like we're almost reaching the end of a cycle. So whether that is Rafael Palladino at Monza, who or Ivan Juric at Torino, two teams that are in 10th and 11th, whether they be also in the frame for maybe not Lazio or a Roma job, but maybe more like Bologna or Fiorentina going forwards. I feel like there'll be a lot of narratives, and if any teams, what will be interesting in that respect is whether any teams decide to act fast in the second half of the season to try and get one of their targets first. I think the other interesting thing that I just finish off on is Serie A is going to be heavily impacted by AFCON and the Asian Cup, but particularly AFCON. If you look at Victor Osimhen departing Napoli for up to a month, that will be a huge blow for them. Ademola Lookman for Atalanta, Dichi Kamada for Lazio, and then lower down in the table, you could look at Lamek Banda, who's been Lecce's star player, in my opinion, so far this season. So how all these teams are going to compete without their star players could also have big ramifications on the league table. And I'm sure Fiorentina and Bologna, who aren't that bigly affected by this, will be licking their lips at the prospect. And Barla Enzola was meant to go for join Angola for the squad, but he's turned that opportunity down, which is a massive boost for Fiorentina. So yeah, I think there's a little bit more of the same, but I think you can certainly watch Serie A in the second half of the season with one eye on future, not just in Serie A and where managers and players may be ending up for next campaign, where we do expect, I guess, massive changes in terms of playing personnel and managing personnel at clubs, but yeah, beyond as well. And we could be seeing some of the sort of breakout of some top managers and players in the second half of the season.
Very nice indeed, Michael. Yeah, looking forward to seeing how the managerial landscape develops in Italy, and yeah, looking forward generally to seeing how the season on the whole develops. Should make for some interesting viewing. Okay, we are going to take a quick break now. I will dial in Rudy Barlow. Michael and Rudy Barlow are going to discuss the latest goings on in Spanish football. We'll be right back.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have Barlow join me now. Not in your typical Spanish surroundings. You're back in Scotland for a couple of weeks. How's your Christmas been, Barlow?
Yeah, it's been good. Apart from cold, it's been nice to see everyone again. And nice to be back at home, have some of the creature comforts that I'm used to. But I feel like by the time I get back, we'll be very much ready for, even if it's just 4 or 5 degrees, it will really help because that wind blows a hole in you, Michael. How's your Christmas been?
Yeah, it's been bitterly cold today, hasn't it? I think other than that, it's not been too bad. Mine's been okay. I've enjoyed being back. I think having like a crumble at 3 o'clock in the afternoon is a bit of a nice change from, yeah, just being stuck in an office at the same time on what would have been a Wednesday afternoon. But yeah, hopefully by creature comforts for you that there's no barking dogs that you get in Madrid. That's, I know that's one of the things that
also an advantage, a big advantage of being back home.
Well, I guess we'll sort of stick with our focus on Spain rather than Scotland going forwards. And regular attendees at this parish will be aware that Ernesto Valverde has the full respect of our resident Spanish football nut. Skulking along the touchline, often assuming his customary crouch, he's turned Los Leones into a tiger. Athletic Club are averaging nearly 2 goals per game and have only been outscored by Atletico Madrid, Girona and Real Madrid. There's just one major misfortune for Athletic so far this season. So tell me and the listener more about that, Barlow.
Yeah, well, it's been a fortune for us to have Girona doing so well. It feels like, especially for Real Sociedad and Athletic Club, their presence in the top four and consequently them being in the top four race is a bit of a kick in the teeth because otherwise they'd be having great seasons. But given Girona are, a good 10 points clear of Athletic, 14 points clear of La Real, Athletic are just 3 points off Atleti and Barca. And so, yeah, anything kind of related to that, you can't really argue with what Valverde is doing. But 34 goals in 18 games, he's reverted this trend of Athletic being a side that always struggle for goals. It's taken a little bit longer than we thought. I think last season, I perhaps expected that kind of transition or that kind of process to speed up a bit. But now, without really changing his resources, Valverde's managed to develop this into a side that is a real threat. And against Atletico Madrid 2 weeks ago now, they beat them 2-0. Nico Williams scored an absolutely flabbergasting goal that was thumped into the top corner. Iñaki Williams on score sheet too. The two of them are just, or Gorka Gurteta, sorry, but the two of the Williams brothers are playing at their best again. And a big part of that is the fact that Iñaki Williams is on the right-hand side. He's playing out wide. And you've seen an increase in effectiveness from him in terms of what he's doing in front of goal. And that's partly, I think, because he's always kind of come through as a winger. He's never really been a centre forward. And even though he'll run a lot, he'll run in behind, he'll stretch the defence, he's a handful. Him being out wide is a major advantage to his game. And to have Nico Williams on the other side, a player who is capable not just of kind of getting in behind, but also going past players, is a massive advantage. The way that Valverde has developed Nico Williams and Oyan Sanset, who's been playing in behind the striker, to not only kind of be kind of promising young talents, players that are technically gifted, players that are kind of pushing for more, they've really come on in terms of how effective they've been. And Sanset is statistically one of the most creative players in La Liga this season. And Nico Williams is one of the hardest dribblers to stop in La Liga this season. Initially, kind of when Nico Williams came through, he was always going to be a handful for the defence. He was always going to be tricky to stop. He has that combination of pace and quick feet, which means that he'll always be able to work a yard of space. And that essentially is what makes the difference at the top level of football these days quite often, is somebody being able to work a yard of space, get that shot off, not under pressure, or be able to thread that pass, be able to find someone. So yeah, Nico Williams always had the talent to do that, but did he have the effectiveness and the know-how of how to work these situations to his advantage, to exploit space in the right way, to find the right option. That was always going to be the incognito, the unknown, as you'd say. And so Valverde has developed him, and I think he's on a pretty clear trajectory on the up for me. And even at the start of the season, you were still seeing Nico miss chances, most notably in the Basque Derby against La Real. He missed a couple of really, really good chances and got abused pretty heavily and pretty nastily as well. But yeah, I think Nico Williams is on path to become a player that not only works that space, not only gets into that space and gets past his defender, but somebody who's lethal when he does do that. Combined with Iñaki and Nico, Sancet is able to provide that kind of balance and that kind of the ability to find a final pass, but also to get into the box. He is a not necessarily a number 10 in the traditional sense, in terms of kind of a controller, but in terms of somebody that kind of plays behind the striker, almost you could perhaps even say kind of Steven Gerrard, like he's really pretty special. And Gorka Guruceta, who is the unsung hero of this, he was signed back to Athletic Club from after a season in the second division or a few seasons in the second division last year, and never really looked like a kind of lethal striker. And this season he's scoring goals, but has not necessarily been lethal either. But one of the things that he does really well, and it was highlighted by Sid Lowe, he was saying that in terms of pure movement, not technically, he was very quick to emphasize, but in terms of pure movement, the ability to kind of get out the way and know exactly where other players are going and be able to provide either the wall pass or drag the defenders away. Guruceta has almost kind of a Benzema-like quality, and yet not the same level, but he's doing a kind of similar job for them, even if technically he's probably not the centre forward that most of us expected to kind of change Athletic's fortunes around. And then there's the kind of classic Valverde traits that have been present at Athletic to varying degrees. Against Atleti, they really gave them a run around. It's the most kind of harrowing sight of Atletico Madrid I've seen all season, because we've seen them be beaten in games before where they've been exposed at the back. We've seen them be beaten in games before where they've just not really turned up or competed at the level that they should have. But this was a game where Atleti did what they could, but were just so thoroughly outplayed, and they didn't have any answer to Athletic. And if they can become that side, if they can kind of reproduce those performances on the regular at home at San Mamés, then it's really hard to see how the likes of kind of Betis, Real Sociedad even, I think, will compete with them, but how those sides below them are really going to catch up to them, because especially right now when they don't have European football, gives them a week to rest. They're raring to go, to come out the blocks, to really kind of go after their opponents. And with the weapons they have now, it's a really quite a sight to see. So yeah, we're talking about an Athletic that for me looks as strong as they have done since Valverde last left them in 2017. So the credit is all his, the players too. But yeah, long may it last, because Nico Williams, if he keeps playing like this, will not be at Athletic Club for long.
Absolutely fascinating. And I guess it just adds to that sight to see at the top of the Spanish league table. And speaking of that, Real Madrid deprived Girona fans of the Christmas gift of looking at the table on the 25th with their side top, a 92nd minute Lucas Vazquez winner against Alaves put paid to that, despite the fact they were a man down. In spite of all the injuries, Real Madrid have been holding the fort down and have fallen into that ever so intimidating pattern of winning games out of habit. What are some of the keys that Carlo Ancelotti has fallen upon almost by accident, Barlow?
Yeah, you can't kind of overstate just how good this season has been for Real Madrid, even if it's not been the most impressive football at all times, even if they've not been blowing teams away at all times. The way that they've handled their injuries, and the way that I guess it partly helps that Barcelona have been somewhat disastrous at times across the road, so to speak, Atleti have not quite been as consistent as they looked in the first part of the season. But the ability to hold the fort down for Ancelotti has been, there's no end of praise. I mean, they're down to two centre-halves. They've got Nacho Fernandez and Antonio Rudiger, the only ones fit. Nacho is suspended for their first game back. But yeah, they're obviously going to look at bringing in a January defender or defensive reinforcement. But Rudiger is, I think he's the third or second player who's played the most minutes in 2023. a player that last season didn't necessarily look that reliable. And yet Real Madrid have the best defence they've had since 1962, I believe it is. And it's not a side that you think of that you necessarily think of as defensive. It's not a side you think of as conservative. It's not a team that you necessarily have huge amounts of defensive faith in. But to be doing that with Lucas Vazquez in the side currently, Carvajal's been there injured, Nacho Fernandez in the side, without Eder Militao, who last season was their best centre-back, David Alaba, who had always been the kind of the first choice partner with him, has now gone down for the rest of the season as well. Thibaut Courtois, we know just how good he is and what an X factor he is when you have him in goals. So to do that, given all the injuries, given kind of the changes in style, given kind of the various things just kind of going on, things going wrong and happening around him, Ancelotti has to take home so much credit with him. But then some of the things that have happened as a result have really kind of improved them or made them look kind of much more formidable. And whether these things work necessarily in Champions League games, I think that's a different matter. But you've got Brahim Diaz, who basically didn't feature in the first half of the season or the first kind of opening third of the season, you could say, until the injuries really start to pile up. And he's coming to the side and they've been playing almost kind of with four forwards at times, with Rodrigo, Bellingham, Brahim Diaz and Hossolu. At times you've dropped Hossolu out as well and moved some of them back. But yeah, Brahim Diaz has been an absolute revelation. He's that perfect link between a midfield and an attack, and it means that Bellingham can be freed up a little bit to go forward, to get into the box and make those deep runs, rather than being that kind of link. Rodrigo the same. The fact that Rodrigo can start on the left-hand side, and yes, I know Vinicius, if you're going to play them both, Vinicius has to be on the left for me. But that doesn't mean that Rodrigo isn't better off that left-hand side. And you've seen a real improvement in his form. He looks more comfortable. He looks like the sort of player which, as he has done, can cut inside, beat two players and thump it into the top corner. And he's done that on two or three occasions. And this is a player that was short of confidence, that was beating players, but you never really had faith in him to finish the chances he was creating. So those two have really improved, and that's made their defence a lot more, or their offence a lot more formidable. But combine that with the fact that Brahim Diaz, he has the mind of a midfielder, even if he's perhaps on the pitch a little bit more of an attacker. So he works his absolute socks off. He to coin a phrase from Xavi, he runs like a pig. And Brahim Diaz has been absolutely excellent for them. And then further back, you've got Ferland Mendy, who's come back from an injury. And Mendy, I mean, he's always going to have doubts at Real Madrid, and they're going to try and replace him with Alphonso Davies in the next summer. And there's reasons, and that's understandable, because Mendy in attack isn't necessarily the best. But the fact that he is there, the fact that he's going to be that kind of third, that kind of hybrid fullback center defender, really helps free up Bellingham as well. It means that Bellingham, who's now been moved to the left in order to do some more defensive work, because they know how good Bellingham is, not only at winning the ball, but also just defending, because he's great at everything, obviously. I think that partnership works really well. Whereas with the likes of Fran Garcia flying forward, you maybe don't get quite the same cover. And it means that Bellingham doesn't have to think as much about his defensive job. Even if when he gets back in shape and when they're without the ball defending deeper, Bellingham will be on the left-hand side. And then finally, Fede Valverde and Toni Kroos. I mean, we know how good Toni Kroos is, but it's worth restating that he's probably been their best midfielder again this season. And Fede Valverde, who's moved into the centre. Now, Valverde was doing a lot of cover work for Carvajal earlier in the season, and I think he's always provided good balance on that right-hand side. But if there's somebody that you've not necessarily been worried about for the last kind of 6-7 months on the right side of Real Madrid's attack, it's been Valverde. He's not quite had that same llegada. He's not got into the box with the same kind of heavy metal arrival and just kind of bulleted his way through defences, knocked them over like a bowling ball almost. But in midfield, he's been absolutely outstanding, because not only has he done his role as kind of a deeper defensive midfielder, partnering Kroos, providing that kind of safety and security, he's also been very, very good at getting into the box every now and then, just providing that extra kind of X-factor threat from midfield, which so often goes wrong. So often you see a midfielder that can do one or the other. They can sit, they can kind of play the ball around, or they can kind of get into the box, they can be a bit more rough and tumble. Whereas Valverde's managed to balance that just right. And I think what we're seeing is his true kind of evolution into the central midfielder he can be. And perhaps he was always the one that I had my doubts about, because you got Tchouaméni, you've got Camavinga alongside him. Valverde is the third member of that three. And I always wondered whether he necessarily had the technical ability to maybe outdo one of those two. And in theory, Bellingham would move back into midfield at some point. But Valverde's passing has been outstanding. He's played the role to absolute perfection. And with somebody like close next to him, who doesn't quite have the legs that he used to, it's been an absolute blessing in disguise for Real Madrid. So those kind of changes, those adaptations have not necessarily been planned, but Carlo Ancelotti somehow, through all of these injuries, through what should be kind of a hazy, wintry fog and kind of a really tricky spell for the club, he's guided them through kind of as if the sun's out and it's shining, and Fede Valverde is kind of gardening, planting some seeds for the future, because yeah, this Real Madrid side, given how many injuries they're dealing with, I think they look kind of formidable for the second half of the season if they can build off what they have now.
Lovely, Barney. Well, I'm sure a lot of other European teams will be keeping an eye on Real Madrid as well. And I watched the Beatles documentary on Disney today, so it's good to hear a bit about Jude. But speaking of another song, Hello Goodbye, Luis Campos is gone at Celta Vigo, a scout renowned for his work at AS Monaco and Real Madrid, amongst others, as well as being a current sporting advisor at PSG. His arrival was celebrated in Galicia when he arrived. He had the reputation for it and the proven track record. So why is his departure being celebrated in Vigo now? And what are the causes?
Yes, well, essentially the cause has to be that Celta Vigo are in 18th place, that Rafa Benitez has come in as this kind of glorious century celebration of Celta Vigo's existence, and things just haven't gone to plan. And I was kind of looking down at his signings and the way that he's managed things. And yeah, you look at Luca De La Torre, he's a good signing. Willett Swedberg is the key one. It cost $5.5 million, which for Celta isn't nothing. He came in from Swedish football. He's just really not managed to get a look in with any of his managers so far, really. Jürgen Trent Larsson struggles with the goals, but $12.5 million on him. He looks like he's probably going to make your money back from Groningen. Tasos Duvikas, another one that came in for $12 million, another striker from the Eredivisie this summer. He's not hit the ground running either. And some of his other signings, Carlos Soto, a Real Madrid youth player, $3 million. Mihailo Ristic from Benfica, $1.5 million. I think he's a decent enough recruit. Carlos Perez, another $5 million, who I think he's a good player and he was really good for Celta last season. But Rafa Benitez seems to have fallen out with him. He doesn't seem to get on with him and he's not been in the team this season. And Carl Starfelt from Celtic as well, who I'm sure many of our Scottish listeners will be familiar with. And then Manu Sanchez and Jonathan Bamba also came in on frees. So his business isn't that bad, but if you kind of look at what the money has been spent on, and bear in mind this is money that came in for Javi Galan, who went to Atletico Madrid, one of their key players, Orbelin Pineda, who also came in and was meant to be kind of a really good signing but never worked out, and of course Gabri Vega, who went to Saudi Arabia for $30 million. So they've had a bit of a budget to spend, and between Duvikas, Perez, Dotor, Swedberg as well, you're looking at kind of 25, 30 millions worth of players that aren't really performing that well. They're doing fine, but they're not necessarily key parts of the side. And yeah, like the Celta, they never seem to be able to kind of just work out their kind of talented parts into a formidable shape for longer than kind of 3-4 months. And Rafa Benitez was Luis Campos' bet. He was the one that Campos wanted to take a gamble in. He brought him in on really big money, and frankly it's gone downhill. And the fact that he's at PSG every weekend, that he's always in the news at PSG, which just happens because he's part of PSG, but the fact that he's always kind of in Paris and looking at that, and the fact that he has such a key role at Celta at the same time, of course if things are going wrong at Celta, then the fans are going to question, well, why are you not dedicating more time to us? Why is this kind of your side hustle where you're just kind of recommending players to us and they're not really working out? So yeah, it was a kind of a it was one of those things where it could have gone spectacularly well if he'd kind of recommended Willett Swedberg and he turned into a superstar. And same again for Trent Larsson or for the likes of Duvikas in the future. But if things are going to go wrong, and if you're responsible for the manager that has Celta in the relegation zone and he's earning a lot of money, reportedly Celtic can't really sack him because he's earning so much, then yeah, of course the fans are going to turn on you. And he has been punted. So yeah, I think it's probably overdue, because when you have that kind of disconnect with the fans and a disconnect with the club, then it's always going to be the first sign of trouble that sees you out on the street.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Barlow. And that was, yeah, really insightful and engaging as always. I guess with Luis Campos, maybe some people are better fit for only working at the very top than for taking on an ego project. Maybe the same could be said for Rafa Benitez also. But yeah, Alistair will be joining us for the next section, as me and him will be discussing all things Bundesliga during the winter break. In Germany, the first half of the 2023-24 campaign has served to reinforce the Bundesliga's reputation as one of the most entertaining leagues in Europe. Xabi Alonso's high-flying Bayer Leverkusen sit top, while just 3 points separate Darmstadt, Köln, Mainz and Union Berlin at the bottom in the race to avoid the drop. From Dortmund's woes to Heidenheim's prolonged fairy tale, the rest of the league table has been laced with riveting storylines and narratives too. Tell us more about their Bundesliga's hectic in Runde, Ali.
Yeah, Michael, the winter break did feel rather timely, giving the clubs, the players, the fans, even the media, I suppose, the chance to take a collective breather. And as you've suggested in the framing of your question, the first half of the season has set matters up really quite deliciously for a bumper running toward the business end of the season. We have a title race, we have stuttering heavyweights, we have iconic strikers belatedly making a name for themselves, we have genuine organic fairy tale stories, we have a relegation battle for the ages, we have all of that and so much more on our hands with this season's Bundesliga. Now, quite simply, there's so much to savour across German football's top flight right now, and sadly we don't have all day to unpack every last development, but I've handpicked a selection of particularly appetising storylines to spotlight now. I'm keen to look firstly, Michael, at Xabi Alonso's high-flying Bayer Leverkusen. It feels like it was only yesterday that we were talking about Bayer's decision to appoint Alonso, but he has now been in charge quite remarkably for over 12 months. Now, we could sit and praise Alonso for all he's managed to implement and achieve so far at the Bayer Arena. We could wax lyrical about how he took them from the relegation zone up to sixth place in his first season in charge, or we could wax lyrical about how this season he's guided Bayer Leverkusen to club record point and goal hauls with 16 games played, or we could speak about how Bayer Leverkusen sailed through the Europa League group stages with 6 wins out of 6, or how they've waltzed their way into the quarterfinals of the DFB Pokal. You get the picture, Michael. But there is one burning question we really ought to answer, and that is whether or not Bayer Leverkusen can really go on and do it, if they can really go on and win the Bundesliga title for the first time in their history. If we're looking at the underlying numbers, Michael, Leverkusen's expected goal difference actually has them sitting third in the table behind Bayern Munich and Stuttgart. And on a similar note, Understat also has them third on expected points. So if you look at the underlying numbers in isolation, you might be minded to think that Bayer Leverkusen will not be crowned champions in May and that they would fall short once again. That said, the underlying numbers do only tell part of the story. And as we've said before on this podcast, what ultimately matters is how many goals you actually score and how many points you actually accrue. And Bayer Leverkusen have done more than enough on and off the pitch to sit 4 points clear at the top of the table after 16 match days, albeit having played a game more than Bayern Munich. And so with that in mind, yeah, I have a good feeling about them going on and, yeah, lifting the Bundesliga title in May. I do think, Michael, that we will learn a great deal about Leverkusen's title credentials in January and early February when top scorer Victor Boniface and defenders Odion Kosunu and Edmund Tapsoba will head off to the Africa Cup of Nations to represent Nigeria, Ivory Coast and Burkina Faso respectively. Now, Boniface, Kosunu and Tapsoba have all played an integral role in Leverkusen's season so far. So up top, Boniface has provided 10 league goals and 7 league assists. And then at the back, you've got Kostin and Tapsoba, who have been key components in a defence that has conceded fewer goals this season than any other team in the division. Now, what is important to note is the fact that Leverkusen have been so well drilled under Alonso. They play with a real balance, and Alonso's found a fairly settled starting 11. And part of me does worry that the temporary departures of Boniface, Kostinou and Tapsoba could disrupt that balance and the team's all-important cohesion. So, yeah, I think a lot will hinge on how well Alonso can manage the transition, if we can call it that. And, yeah, those high-profile absences. For the benefit of the listener, the Africa Cup of Nations will run for nearly a month, from January 13th until February 11th. So during that period, Leverkusen will have the derby against Gladbach. They'll have encounters with the three other sides currently making up the top four. So that's Bayern Munich, Stuttgart and RB Leipzig. And they'll also have visits to Augsburg and Darmstadt. So yeah, a really quite crucial set of fixtures. If Alonso can navigate the good ship Leverkusen through that potentially complicated run of games, and if they can come out the other side of January and early February still ahead of, or at the very least keeping pace with, Bayern Munich, then I think we can really start to think about this Bayer Leverkusen outfit as genuine title contenders. In any event, Michael Victor Boniface's absence will provide Road to Nowhere cult hero Patrick Schick with a golden opportunity to rediscover the form he showed with the Czech Republic at the Euros in 2021, when he, of course, broke Scottish hearts with that long-range effort, catching David Marshall far too far off of his line. And also the form that he then showed with Leverkusen in the 2021-2022 Bundesliga campaign. He has missed a lot of football in the last 14 months or so through injury, but we did see what looked like a statement of intent from him when he made his first start of the season in the league anyway against Bochum just before Christmas and netted a 16-minute hat-trick. That felt very Patrick Schick, probably the most Patrick Schick hat-trick there could be. And if he stays fit, if he quickly finds his feet again in front of goal, then he single-handedly will go a long way to massaging the pain of losing somebody as influential as Victor Boniface at such a crucial point in the season. Elsewhere, Heidenheim, they have defied all expectations in their debut Bundesliga campaign. We've spoken previously, Michael, you'll probably remember this, you'll hopefully remember this, about their multifaceted fairy tale. So you've got the town of Heidenheim, which has a population of about 50,000, which for context is only a few thousand more than the population of Kilmarnock. The club stadium holds just 15,000 people, which makes it the smallest ground in the Bundesliga and actually makes it a smaller stadium than Kilmarnock's rugby park. The club's coach, Frank Schmidt, is the longest serving current manager in Europe's top five leagues, having been in charge for 16 years and counting. So Schmidt is the very definition of a local hero. He was born in Heidenheim and was raised nearby Gengen, if that's how you pronounce it. Pretty sure that's how you pronounce it, but do feel free to correct me, listener. Do feel free to get in touch if I've butchered the pronunciation there. So Schmidt actually spent the latter years of his playing career at the club before hanging up his boots in 2007 and becoming the club's assistant manager. A couple of months later, he was promoted to manager and he's been the main man in the dugout ever since, guiding the club from the fourth tier of German football all the way to the Bundesliga, where he has continued, Michael, to work miracles. I'm delighted with how well Heidenheim have fared so far in the top flight. At just about the halfway point in the season, they find themselves in ninth place and 10 points clear of the relegation zone, so fairly comfortable at this point in the season. As the official Bundesliga website puts it, their success has been based mainly on sheer hard work. They currently sit second in the league for distance covered and top in the league for the number of sprints. The American midfielder Leonard Maloney is the embodiment of the team's graft and the team's spirit, and only a certain Granit Xhaka has actually run further in the Bundesliga so far this season. Now, Heidenheim will evidently need to carry the same levels of intensity, the same levels of hard work, the same levels of application into the new year if they want to avoid being dragged into a relegation battle. But they've already made a real name for themselves and written several memorable headlines. You may or may not have seen this, Michael, but their last gasp 3-2 win against Freiburg in their final game before the winter break was particularly dramatic. They quite heroically picked up all 3 points after trailing 2-1 heading into the final 10 minutes of that game. And coincidentally, only four teams have actually picked up more points from losing positions than Heidenheim this season, which I think really speaks to the team's character and the team's resilience. Quite simply, Michael, they've been a great addition to the league, something a little bit different, and I'm really looking forward to watching more of them in the second half of the campaign. Turning our attention briefly now to the Bundesliga's relegation battle. As you say, Michael, you have four teams separated by 3 points. So you have Darmstadt in 18th, Köln in 17th, and Mainz in 16th, all on 10 points. And then you have Union Berlin in 15th place on 13 points. Union have a game in hand, but they're still very much part of that relegation battle. Three of those bottom four teams have already parted company with their coaches. So Bo Svensson vacated his position as Mainz head coach by mutual consent at the start of October. Union Berlin said a really quite emotional goodbye to Urs Fischer a few weeks later. And then Köln and Steffen Baumgart went their separate ways just before Christmas. So quite how Union Berlin, Köln and Mainz adapt or continue to adapt to life post Fischer, Baumgart and Svensson respectively will go a long way to shaping the outcome of the Bundesliga relegation battle. What we have seen, Michael, with Union Berlin, with Köln and with Mainz is a series of burst bubbles, perhaps most emphatically so in Union Berlin's case. We lavished praise on each of those sides and they're now departed coaches in the not too distant past, but that's the nature of football. Things change, managers and players alike move on and the good times come and ruthlessly go. So I think on that rather somber note, we will draw this episode of the podcast to a close. I do just want to give Michael the chance to promote an exciting project of his. Michael, tell us all about your upcoming podcast.
Oh, thank you very much, Ali. And that was, yeah, really good to listen to. Well, you mentioned with Boniface and a few other players, you know, there's going to be a massive focus on international football from the next few days. We've got AFCON and the Asia Cup in the next month or so, and then we got the Oceania Cup for the first time since 2016, the Euros, Copa America as well. So yeah, I thought it'd be a very good time to launch something I've wanted to do for a while, an international football podcast, which is called the World Ranking International Football Podcast. That's at World Ranking Pod on Twitter. I know that's where we have most of our sort of followers from. So if you want to follow it on there, that would be really appreciated, and I hope you enjoy the content that we put on. There'll be weekly podcasts with interviews with regional experts, but also with managers and players, and then we'll also have little videos, little clips of interviews and stuff to share around as well. So yeah, a lot of different content, but you know, a lot of it also, you know, one of the things we've loved doing on this podcast for ages is talking about stories that may not have been that well told about normally, and I think there'll be a similar theme to that in that respect, that we'll be looking to uncover some of those interesting stories around the globe that you might not typically see when you're browsing through a lot of football content. But yeah, that I'm sure that's enough for me. The first episode will be out on January the 3rd, so just a few days after this one, if you want to give it a listen.
Good stuff, Michael. Thoroughly looking forward to hearing the first episode and yeah, to following the podcast generally. Yeah, looking forward to that a lot. Okay, well, I'll say thank you to Michael Jones. I'll say thank you to Rudy Barlow, and I'll say thank you to you, the listener, for your ongoing support. We'll see you in 2 weeks for another episode of the Road to Nowhere podcast. In the meantime, have a happy new year when it comes. Stay safe and stay well. Goodbye.